Well, thank you very much. We're kind of the walking wounded up here, Chief. We're both vocally impaired at the moment. There'll be a lot of gratitude on the East Coast if I go back with no voice. I am just absolutely delighted to be here, and I've thoroughly appreciated the conference. This is the spirit is just absolutely contagious here, and has been since we drove up, and I really appreciate that. It's a great feeling. There are signs of life in the northwestern corner of the United States, and I was just really glad to be in the middle of it. That's high energy. I've been busy. I really have been busy. And that's what I came here to do, was be busy. And so you guys have really fulfilled my... God, I thought you had a message for me. That scared me bad. So you guys have really have fulfilled my wishes. And so I'm going to be hanging around a little bit more later on tonight. And folks that wanted to chat, feel free to just have at it. I think the voice will hold out that long. I hope so anyway. So let me get right to work. I need to tell you who I was. My God, I haven't told you since this afternoon. It's Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And member of the Primary Purpose Group, Southern Pines, Sobriety Day, Groundhog Day 57, and kudos to our senior here. I tell you, it's great to be in a conference where I'm not the oldest rat in the barn. I have just delighted to see that. And that Graying of America crowd that stood up there was a pretty doggone frisky-looking bunch of folks. And I was just glad to see that. Glad to see that you're still dynamically involved in this thing. And that's just great to see. And congratulations to the fellow with 3 days. That's just great. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. What I want to do is do what we do. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And that's what I want to do in a general way, is tell you what I used to be like. Don't want to lecture you or give you any more information or any stuff like that. I just want to tell you my story. And that goes in a lot of just goofy kind of directions, but it's all right. We'll wind up somewhere close to home. I was a guy, I think I was just a natural setup for at least having trouble with booze, if not alcoholism. And what I mean by that, I think there are two things that are required for alcoholism to occur. One is a predisposed personality. I think if you don't have that tilt in the right direction, it just won't catch. It just won't connect. And so you got to be set up for it so that it has that sort of magnified importance, that magnified value. Otherwise, you know, why mess with it? And so I had that. I'm not a causation freak, but I'm not the village idiot either. I know that there's a lot more to drinking than just drinking. I also know there's a lot more to not drinking than just not drinking. It's a far more complex illness than that. So I'm not going to visit in it too much tonight, except to say that being predisposed is more than just having some sort of a chemical makeup that's conducive to interaction with alcohol. Yeah, I grew up so that I developed some traits and characteristics and coping mechanisms that we call defects of character. And I developed those things early on. And I was a setup for this thing. I was a guy who, I heard somebody say one time, made eminent sense to me, that we alcoholics are not a unique breed. We're just like any other human being, only more so. And I think it's owing to that defects of character thing, that we alcoholics have the same drives, urges, impulses as any other human being. But ours are strained through those defects, and it causes it to come out wanting more, longer, better. You know, and it's just that sort of the illness of more. And so I think that's the only thing that's out of whack about it, and what set me up to be such a ready host for alcohol when I started to drink. And the first time I drank, seriously, I don't mean just emptying up glasses on the table, but the first time I drank seriously, man, it hit a home run. I just absolutely fell in love with that stuff. It did something for me. It took all the rough edges and the rough places in my life, the uncomfortable aspects of my life, and transformed them into assets. And I went immediately from this kind of a reclusive holdback guy to a charging straight ahead guy. And I not only fit in well, I'd just take over if I got a chance. I mean, it just turned me loose. I would have been a pure idiot to not drink. Anything that did that much good for me, man, I'm going to have some more of that. That's the cheapest therapy I ever had in my life. Cheaper than psychiatry, I'll tell you that. And so I was just a natural. You know, it just sort of clicked with me, and I loved it. I was not an alcoholic. I was not a born alcoholic. I just had those kind of peculiar characteristics that made booze important. And I had a fairly extended period of social drinking. It lasted about 2 years. And I started serious drinking at 16, and by the time I was 18, I was full-blown alcoholic. You know, some of us just happen quickly. Alcoholism develops sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But it always happens if we'll hang with it long enough, for most of us. And so I was just one of those folk that I was a quick bloomer. I think I was one of the early prototypes of the type that's very common today. I mean, you used to be, way back when the older members came in here, that we were essentially bourbon-swilling Puritans. And we grew slowly. I mean, we just sort of drank on and then one day went off the end of the pier and didn't come back up. But there are others who are basket cases from day one. That was me. And so I think I was one of the early models of that type of just absolute just social disaster. Yeah, so that's what I was. I was a wild, crazy young fellow, found immediate release in booze, fell in love with that lifestyle, loved everything about it. I loved the places where we practiced the art. That's a euphemistic term. Particularly some of the places where I practice it. I just loved them all. I loved those old rock'em, sock'em, redneck joints down in North Carolina. They specialize, I think they probably still do it, they call them square dances. I think it has nothing to do with dancing. I used to practice that a lot, but it has nothing to do with any rhythm or sort of stuff like that. It's basically like human bumper cars. They just, people get out there and bang each other on the floor. They play till they get tired, then they quit, they go out in the parking lot, drink and fight. They go back in and dance some more. I loved that. And then when I got city-fied and sophisticated, I loved those jazz joints. I'm a great jazz lover. And I loved it drunk. Man, I could sit in one of those smoky joints where you couldn't even see the guy next to you. And man, somebody hit that old sultry sax, and man, that just take me right out of here. I loved that kind of stuff. So I was a natural in that environment. I loved the trashy behavior. that sort of sense that something's getting ready to jump off. And if it don't jump off here, it'll sure be at the next place. You know, I'm going right down there. And if it don't jump off pretty quick, I'm going to start something just to get it going. So that was a natural. That was my environment. I just functioned well there, fit right in, required no training. It was as natural as breathing. And I'll let you on a little secret. I enjoyed it enough that had I not had the misfortune of developing alcoholism, I'd be doing it tonight. Now, I don't mean to try to recruit any drinkers. Unless you're not done. If you're not done, get done, then hurry back. But I didn't stop drinking on moral grounds. I'm not a Puritan. I'm not a teetotaler. I'm all for booze, as a matter of fact. I like to see people drink. And if they ever ask me for a drink, they better be serious. Because I guarantee you, I treat them like they're serious. And I'll have you knee-walking drunk before you can get there. Well, I mean, I don't feel bad about that. I just sort of could. That's my personal recruiting effort. I figure if folks going to do it, I just soon get it on over with and then get on in here. I'm not burdened down with a lot of morality and principles and ethics about that stuff. I just get it on, get it over with, and let's get started. And so that's what happened. You know, so I'm banging away, and then I developed alcoholism. Now, I could attribute it to a lot of stuff. You know, most of it's complicated enough that I don't even understand it. I just know this, and I'd love to tell you the whole story, but we got to hurry. I got a plane leaving at noon tomorrow, so I've got. I was a kind of guy, and I really do want to just sort of not tell all night about it. I'd love to tell all night what it's like. I love those stories. God, I just love drunk along. Some people say they're yucky. God, give it to me, man. I love drunk along, especially mine. So I was a guy that I think, like a lot of folk, they use that word potential with us a lot of times. And I really think there's something to it. I was the kind of guy that typically, because I came along so young, I would snap back quickly. I mean, I could wake up pitiful, incomprehensibly demoralized, and by nighttime, I'm ready to go. I'm gung-ho. I just snap back in a hurry. And when I was clean, not drunk, I looked pretty good. I mean, I just had a remarkable ability, for some reason, to make good impressions on people. I've been overrated all of my life. That's the God's truth. I'm still overrated, man. People think I know stuff. I don't know anything. I just sit around quiet most of the time looking wise. And so, then I'll speak up and spoil the whole thing. But I was always kind of overrated. I was the kind of guy, if I was sober, if I would go looking for a job, I would get hired for a better job than I was looking for. And that's God's truth. I mean, I just had that faculty for making people think I was a real go-getter. I supervised 151 people when I was 17 years old. Not very long, but they were mine for a while, man. I tell you what. And that was my career pattern. I was the type of guy, I'd get a job, I'd start out here and then work my way down. I never had a promotion in my life that I recall. Never had a pay raise unless they raised the minimum wage. I never did. But I looked good at a given time. When I went in the military, I loved it for about 30 minutes. Then I met the first guy in charge, and that guy had never seen me before, started talking to me like a dog. And, man, you cut somebody in North Carolina for talking to you like that. And I'm trapped. I tried to quit, and they won't let you quit. And I kept trying to quit persistently, and they kept catching me and locking me up. And so I finally quit quitting, and they threw me out. But in the interim, I had a typically remarkable kind of a career. Well, I don't know how remarkable I do know my performance was not all that remarkable. I was an eight ball at a first order. I made Gomer Pyle look like a national hero. But I went through training, and I was picked out of 1,000 men as being one of the 5 outstanding soldiers in that bunch. When they called my name, I said, huh? And guys around me said, huh? It tells you about government evaluation. And they sent me off. They were sending me into leadership, but I was going to be developed to become an officer. That's still ludicrous. That's so goofy. And then they saw what they had on their hands, and I was stationed up in Alaska and Adak in the Aleutian Islands. Wonderful place. You ought to rush up there. And anyway, that sort of, if you get the picture, here's a guy that's not unlike many other alcoholics. Mine might have been a little more bizarre. But my God, how many people do I know who have this wonderful ability to make amazing starts and then fall over their own feet? That amazing propensity to take a drink at exactly the wrong time. And that was the story of my life. But these real wonderful beginnings and just absolute self-destruction. And so I don't think being in ADAC out there in the Aleutian Islands really caused me to develop alcoholism. I've learned a word here, exacerbate. I think that means, and then it got worse. I think that's what happened to my alcoholism. I think it just revved it up a few years and probably accelerated about 10 years, I think, because I did my very honest best effort to stay blind drunk the whole time I was there. And somewhere in the middle of that, I crossed the line. Now, I didn't notice it when I crossed it. Didn't even see it. I had absolutely no awareness. I didn't even know there was one. But when I got sober and didn't look back and started to put that life together, it seemed to me not real clear, but undeniable that there was a point where my drinking changed from what it had been to something else called alcoholism. Now, it would have been hard to find with a runaway train like me, because mine was not a subtle process. It might have been a subtle process in that I didn't see it, but I did not notice any change in what I did. I went to the same jails after I was alcoholic as I did before. Got the same nose broke by some of the same people. That was a, well, and so there was no big change except one. And to me, the change that came is the one that fits what I believe to be the best definition of alcoholism I've ever heard. It's in the third chapter of our book. One simple little innocuous sentence that says, "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking." To me, that is the heart and soul, the most pure, absolutely distinct definition of alcoholism. God knows I've read 600 definitions or more. I've never heard one that gets more to the point than that. And I love that definition because it gets to the heart. You know, when I say what I just said to you, what I have done is describe the sum total of my problem, period. Everything else is circumstantial to that fact. Everything else. You know, I'm a guy who cannot control his drinking. And when I take a drink, I cannot predict what will happen. How much, how long, what. I drank hydraulic brake fluid one time, for God's sakes. I didn't mean to. Some Yankee bootlegger sold me that stuff. And I guarantee you it worked. It put me on the next planet, and it locked me tighter than a drum, too, for a week. And I never was sick. I never did drink any more of that. I got nor bought any other rot gut that I didn't smell first. But anyway, that doesn't define alcoholism. That's just stupidity. And so the sum total of my problem is that I'm somebody who can't drink. I lost that ability. And I loved it. I love it because when I came into AA, I was quite young. And by today's standard, I was a geriatric case, but I was 24 years old. And I'll assure you, in 1957 at Hill Valley Ward, there weren't any 24-year-olds coming off the production line. Not that I ever saw. And so I was incredibly young to have this kind of a thing. So I love that definition. One of the things that I found difficult when I first got in AA was identifying with other people. Because we can tell people, identify, don't compare all you want to. But when you're sitting there and the person on either side of you outweighs you by 25 years of drinking, you're going to compare. I mean, there's no way around it. And so that's why I love that definition, because it gets away from all the Wild West stuff. It has nothing to do with how long I drank, how much I drank, what I did when I drank. I got married one time drunk to a woman I didn't even know. I'd know who she was. Well, I knew she was Mrs. Ivester. I knew that. But I didn't mean that. I guarantee you, whatever I said to her must have been dazzling. She obviously didn't know me, and that marriage did not last long, long term. Alimony is just the same. Don't make a difference whether you meant it or not. But that doesn't define alcoholism. You know, that's just the occupational hazards of being drunk. I mean, stuff's going to happen. But they don't define alcoholism. You know, that's not what defines. What defines it, you know, I know good, decent alcoholics, some probably in this room, who've never been to jail. Can you believe that? I mean, where did you drink, for God's sakes? In a vault? I mean, they're real decent alcoholics, real alcoholics. Married to the same woman, for God's sakes. Something wrong with that. But those things are not qualifiers, you know. Yeah, I'm a guy who lost the ability to control his drink. That has nothing to do with how old I am. Whether I'm black, white, brown, polka dot, nothing to do with that. Whether I'm rich or poor, highly educated or borderline stupid. Nothing to do with that. Whether I'm gay, straight, or undecided, it makes absolutely no difference. You know, those things have nothing to do with alcoholism. They're just human traits, you know, and things that happen. Alcoholism, I hit on it because it's fundamentally important to me. I'm a person who lost the ability to control his drinking. If I take a drink, I'm in deep, deep trouble because there is something physiologically, psychologically, chemicologically, or whatever logical. But there is something out of whack with me. And if I take a drink, I am flat in trouble. And that's the sum total of my problem. The rest of it are just the stuff that happens. And so that happened when I was 18 years old. I certainly didn't notice it because I was quite drunk, I'm sure, at the time. And there was no bell rung. I didn't hear it if it did. And so I just plowed on and then proceeded on through life, screwing up everything I got in touch with. And it was, if you were a sociologist documenting on a chart, you know, you would have seen just a very predictable kind of incremental deterioration of a guy. But there is a subtle process to it. You know, it's always kind of interesting to me, and I don't want to get too profound here because I won't be able to keep up with it. But it's really interesting to me that, you know, in the popular conversation about alcoholism and a lot of other human ills, we really beat on a term called denial. And we've adopted that term because it seems to have utility in AA, but it really doesn't have any place here. Because one place you will not find it is in any of our literature. You won't find it in a big book. And obviously, if you read much of Bill Wilson, you know that he had the words. He didn't use it because I don't think the term applied. A denial is basically sort of an intellectual joust with the realities that are closing in. And then that kind of intellectual battle with that thing of pushing it away. What Bill talked about, and I'm sure most of you are well familiar with it, he referred to illusion. Not denial, to delusion. You know, an inability to differentiate the true from the false. An inability to see life as it is. And in that sense, even though my life looked like a runaway, just an absolutely runaway catastrophe, it was a subtle process in that, really when look at it now, you know, as I deteriorated, I never saw realistically what was happening to me. My life was almost an endless series of waking up with no clue of where I was or what I'd done, with that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization that was my constant companion. And I never once put it together. I was somebody, I don't know if I was just incredibly slow, but I was somebody who had great difficulty connecting when I first got an A and I heard people talking about it's the first drink that gets you. I thought that's the dumbest thing. The first drink's never done anything to me. You know, all I do is take another drink and then another one and then wake up in jail in Alabama or somewhere. But I never put it together. You know, I never did come to in one of those, whatever it was, and say, geez, I shouldn't have started drinking. I never put it together. You know, people would tell me that I ought not to drink. That seems stupid, you know, because drinking was the only real pleasure, real outlet that I had. I just never did connect it. When I took a drink, it didn't act with me like it did with average people. that it was just an absolutely tiger unleashed, and I didn't know that. And so that's why it's that kind of thing of recognizing that the reality of this illness is not what happens on the outside, it's what happens on the inside. And the reality of my alcoholism, not how many times I went to jail and psych wards and broken stuff and all of this kind of stuff, those are not the realities. The reality is of being a young man who was at such a point of demoralization that I would look at myself in a mirror and want to gag at what I saw. Take a look at my life, and the best I could come up was, "By God, man, why don't you just end it? Everybody would be better off." You know, really on a roll. You know. And so I had those kinds of moments of just absolute anguish. But in the course of it, never did really connect. I never believed. I was thrown out of the military with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism. It fazed me not at all. I thought, that's dumb, man. I'm just a world beater getting ready to happen. I really believed that I was somebody that one of these days is going to get it together, and I'm going right down the tube, and never did see it. And so when I got out of the military, I bombed around and had drifted up to the state of Michigan. And I lived for my final years in the state of Michigan. Well, not my final years, but led up to my final years in the state of Michigan in a city called Flint. And if you haven't been to Flint, you owe it to yourself to go. Or if you don't want to go there, you might try Baghdad. It's about the same genre, so you could get what you want either place. Anyway, I mean, yeah, a place with a reputation like it attracts people like me. And I guess that's why I just wandered up there with a bunch of drunks. Didn't have any ambition. Didn't want to own General Motors. Got to work and started working building cars. They told me that's what I'd do. I didn't know what I didn't have much to do with building cars. But they thought it did, and they paid me for a while until they decided my practices weren't all that good. I always feel bad when I tell folks that I helped build the 53 and 54 Buicks. I always think I'm going to run into somebody that bought one. It's driving down the highway and a steering wheel just came off. Anyway, that's what it did. Then my reputation got ahead of me in a city of 500,000 people. And I became unemployed and darn near unemployable. Yeah, my reputation was ahead of me. I couldn't get a job in an industry, and then it just sort of drifted off into just sort of piecemeal stuff and day labor and picking up and getting some haven in some rooming house or taking advantage of some kind-hearted person that wanted to help me out. And I made a specialty of that kind of stuff. I wasn't reared to live like I lived the last couple of years that I was hustling around up in that state. It's a strange thing, though, that as I moved into that way of life, a pattern of behavior that would have been totally unthinkable to me at one time became remarkably normal. I wasn't reared to do that. I wasn't a predatory criminal, but I lived in a place that was a jungle, and you either lived by the laws of the jungle or you didn't live. And it was just survival of the fittest on a daily basis. And I wasn't reared to do that kind of stuff, but it became natural. And up in that kind of an environment, you were either the rollee or the roller, and depending on who was friskiest on a given day. I wasn't reared for that kind of stuff, but it became natural, just a natural thing. Sold my blood, $5 a throw. I wasn't reared for that either, but it became natural. I'd have let them pump me dry if they hadn't had controls on folks like me. And so I was just sort of a guy that was just blasting along. Absolutely falling apart. I knew that I was destined to have a pretty short life. I never believed I'd make 30. And I believe that was probably an accurate prediction had I not been brought to a stop. And now I've got a lot of friends in this group, a lot of folks that I know very, very well. And many of you are aware that mine was a story. It was zany and crazy in a lot of ways, but like so many alcoholic stories, there's always some heartbreak and tragedy that precedes any kind of a coming together. We rarely just logically decide that we've had enough. It normally takes some tragedy. And I was a guy, I mean, I knew that I was kind of a reckless guy and a guy that was capable of anything just because of how I acted. But I never, just like anybody, I never believed I would ever do anything unpardonable and anything that would be the kind of stuff that I feared, the kind of stuff that used to make me, come when I'd come to, just be filled with panic, trying to figure out where I was and what I'd done and what this time. And that was commonplace for me. And so I came to one morning in Flint, in a very familiar surroundings. I was in the jail, and that was a normal routine. And so when I came to, saw where I was, I could just kind of relax and settle in. And then after I was awake for a while, I went up to the bars, and a jailer came by that I knew quite well. And he walked by, and I called out to him, and I said, "Hey, guy, when can I get out?" And he would normally say 10 o'clock. Yeah, that was the drunk getting out time. And so he didn't say that this morning. He said, "I hope never," and hardly looked at me. I knew he was not kidding. The man was serious. That was obvious. But I had no clue what he was talking about. And then I walked back into the tank in there, and some of the guys apparently had been listening to the news or something. And they were talking about this fella who had been driving blind drunk, blacked out down the main street of that city, and ran down and killed two people. And I knew, even though I had absolutely no clue of what they were talking about, I knew that they had to be talking about me. And they assured me that that was true. And that, you know, it's a funny thing about the human mind. It will only accommodate what it can handle. That explains a lot of behavior to me. It won't take in information that it can't handle. And my response was just to push it away and say, no, it couldn't be. But it was, and that's finally when it settled in, reality settled in. I just wanted to disappear. I was done. I was absolutely done. So full of grief and shame that I was ashamed to be breathing. And it's the only time I'd ever been in jail. I didn't try to get out. I didn't call anybody. I didn't want anybody to know. I just wanted to be gone. And so, for some reason, there was a policeman there at that place. I've never known who he was, but he saw that I was just in one big mess. And for some reason, he took it on himself, called my folks down in North Carolina. He learned, saw my record, I guess, that had family, and they looked him up, called him, said, "You got a guy up here in a lot of trouble." And my family came and made what so far has been their last trip to anybody's jail to get me out. I didn't want them to come there. I didn't want them to get me out. But I didn't know how to say that to anybody. How do you tell somebody I don't want to get out? I wasn't able to communicate anything. And so when they came, I would just let them do whatever they were doing. They got an attorney. I was charged with manslaughter, scheduled for trial later that year, and they got me released on bond. Now, I did not believe that I was alcoholic. I had never seriously considered that. But after that happened, I knew that I could never drink again. I mean, I didn't ponder it or agonize over it. I just knew that how could you possibly drink after something like that? I just didn't understand. I didn't understand anything about alcoholism or that I had it. I was released on bond on the 17th of July of 56. And I knew that I wouldn't drink, but I didn't know what I would do. And what I did do was like any tormented man wandering the streets. I couldn't stand to be around anybody, couldn't look anybody in the eye, and I just walked the streets all day, all night, till about noon the next day, and of course I drank. Like nobody I've ever seen, I have literally worked with thousands of alcoholics. I mean thousands of alcoholics. I've never worked with one like me. I was a guy who just gave in to the condition. And, man, a wino could have diagnosed me. I was very mechanically, methodically trying to drink myself to death. That was obvious. And it's obvious that that didn't happen. And then on the 19th of November of 56, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. You know, sometimes that's confusing people. I tell them my anniversary is February 2nd. My last drink on November the 19th, I finished a bottle of gin with just 3 or 4 inches in the bottle and went to court. And so far, by the grace of God, that has been my last drink. But that's not what I celebrate. I celebrate my recovery. You know, that had nothing to do with recovery. That had to do with my being locked up. So I wouldn't have drunk anyway. So, you know, I don't celebrate that, but I don't ever pass on November the 19th without thinking of it. That's for doggone sure. So that day on the 19th, finished that bottle, went down to court. There was no trial in the sense of the prosecution. Defense, I had no defense. The hell of blackouts, and if you've had them, I don't need to explain it to you. The hell of blackouts is I couldn't even be a witness at my own trial. All I can say is I don't know. I've never had any recollection whatsoever. Some people say blackouts are just an excuse to keep from facing the truth. That's a bunch of bohunk. That is just not so. You know, I have absolutely, that's absolute curtain dropped on that. I've had many episodes of it, not just that one. But no, absolutely no recall, but no doubt whatsoever. And so when they finished that trial, I listened to it as if I owned a jury. And it was apparent that I was absolutely guilty, and I swear I was found and sentenced to a max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, you know, as you gathered, I was not exactly raised in a greenhouse. The vicissitudes of life were fairly frequent to me. I understood them. But there's a big difference between an overnight flop in a jail and a drunk tank and or 30 days in a stockade or a pea farm and where I don't know that I had ever consciously recognized a penitentiary. I probably went by many of them, but I just never did really connect it. And so I didn't know what it was, but I knew that a lot of the guys that I hustled around with on the street were in and out of the one I was going to, and I knew it couldn't be Disneyland with people like that in it. And so it was a very human instinct. I had a reaction of fear, very real, just a panic reaction of fear when that sentence was passed. But the most real sense of relief I had ever known, because I knew it was done. I'm not talking about a new beginning. I'm talking about an end. It's done. And my conscious thought was, well, you won't hurt anybody else, big guy. And that's really what I thought. And the next day I was led into that place, absolutely convinced I would never come out, and truly did not care. And that was the frame of mind. It wasn't anger, bitterness, or anything like that. It was just total, absolute, crushing defeat. I mean, I was done. And so they checked me in. I went into severe isolation. I was always a kind of an isolated guy, but booze made me kind of a social go-get-em type of guy. But I was basically I was an isolated type of fella, and so went in, and they put me in a cell. I never engaged in a conversation with anybody. I didn't know who was in the cell on either side of me, and it wasn't I didn't care. They just didn't exist. I was just locked in total isolation to myself. And I'll tell you this: those of you who are in the workshop today know that I have strong feelings about any service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the reasons I have strong feelings about CPC, I mentioned today about the strong loyalty we have for what kick-started the process for us. I tell you where that came from with me, at least the origin of it. When I went in that place, and you could go to the bank on this, I've got no need to prove it nor ability, but had my finding a new way of life depended on any initiative by me, I would never have come. I would never have asked for help. And it wasn't the anger or bitterness. It was the overwhelming sense of worthlessness. I couldn't have asked anybody for a drink of water, never mind help. I would have absolutely wasted away and gone out of that place toes up, had it not been for somebody taking just a little intervention. And I'll tell you what happened, because you've got the picture. This is not a prize case that you're looking at. And if you'd have gone through that place, there were 6,000 guys locked up in there. If you'd have gone through that and looked them over and looked for winners, I guarantee you I'd have been close to the bottom of the totem pole on that. And here's what happened. Now, I'm exactly who I said to you. You heard and believe. This is no soap opera. This is the absolute truth. And so I'm sitting in that cell just vegetating, doing anything I could do to keep from thinking is what I was doing. And one day, the guy that worked there sent for me, and I went down and he did one of those interminable kinds of interviews, social history type of thing. I'd been through many of those things. You probably have too. And I could do those in my sleep. And this guy got through with his questions, and I have never had but one diagnosis in my life. A lot of synonyms, but it was the same thing. You're a drunk. You're a problem drinker. You're an alcoholic, on and on. I'd heard that. That's the only diagnosis I ever had. And it would always go to something nonsensical to me, like, why don't you quit drinking? And I never could think of a good reason. I mentioned about a while ago, I just didn't connect it to the disasters, you know. And this guy got through with his interview, and he made the same diagnosis. He said, man, little devil, he said, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. I mean, my God, that's obvious, man. I got a record that thick, and that's all it's about is booze and trouble. I've never been in trouble in my life sober. None of those bizarre things I described occurred, even less than total drunk, you know. So, I mean, that's just obvious. It did take a rocket scientist to diagnose that. So he said, you've had a lot of trouble. And then he said something I had never heard. He said, we have an AA group here, and I think you ought to go. Now, this wasn't a capturing kind of thing. This was not some kind of a saying, if you don't go, we're going to put you against a wall or you'll never get out. None of that stuff. There was no coercive quality. The guy had just made a conversational observation that, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. An AA group here, you ought to go. Friendly advice. And I doubt if I would have acted on that, because I'm sure none of that really connected me. I remember it, but I wouldn't have taken action on that. That was a little too simple. And then a little later, a few days later, I got a little note from him, just a little slip of paper, and it said, you know, it's 6,000 guys locked up, and everything was crowded, including the AA group. It was only space for 300 people. And you had to have a seat open before you could be cleared to go. I didn't know any of that. I learned it later. But he sent me a note and said, you're okay to go. You can go to your first meeting February 2nd of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. I didn't want to go anywhere. You know, the last thing, some of you probably have experienced, but the last thing isolated people want to do is go mix it up with a bunch of folks. Yeah, I didn't want to go anywhere. I mean, I didn't care what it was. It would be the AA or the Ku Klux Klan or anything else. I was interested in nothing except sitting in that cell and just staring at my navel, and that was it. But I was blessed, thank God. It's an amazing thing about our program. Everything in AA is built on surrender. Every step is just another increment of surrender. It's not the ladder to success, it's the ladder to surrender. Absolute, total surrender. And I was blessed. I was absolutely blessed with being so beaten that I had no resistance. I had none. And when I got that note, I just got up like a trained puppet or something. I just got up and went wandering over to the school building where that group met and walked into my first AA meeting. It had an officer on the door. And he read my name on the shirt, Ivester, yesterday. He said, sit down, listen to my first AA meeting. And I didn't know what they were going to do. I thought it was going to be some kind of a religious hootenanny of some sort, because the only people I ever saw trying to help drunks would be, you know, some of these clean old folks that would come to county jail and sing Amazing Grace and stuff like that. That's what I thought you helping drunks was about. And I'd go for it every time they came. I'd go there and listen to them, pat my foot, cry, and get converted. I got converted to everything, man. If whatever they were selling, I'd get it. It lasts about 30 minutes. And I figured it's going to be something like that. So I walked in, and they did the meeting, much like we did ours. The mouth of that meeting wasn't quite as pretty as ours, but... They read a lot more stuff. I swear to God, man, when they read open at me, they read everything but the phone book, man. They read a bunch of stuff. And the first thing they did was pray. And when they were praying, I'm thinking, yeah, see there, I knew it. Going to be a revival. bring the snakes out here in just a minute. And I was shut down in that part of my life totally. And so anything even rhymed with religion got me uptight big time. So I did that, and I thought, you know, so churchy like so far. Then they had first speaker I ever heard. And this fellow told his story, and that was the darndest thing I'd ever heard in my life. I mean, I'd heard drunks tell stories, but not their own. That boy had to be telling his... I know it had to be true. Nobody's going to make that up. I mean, good God, that was bizarre. And I didn't identify with one syllable of any word he said. And the amazing thing was, the next week I was back. There's no mystery to me about, you know, the only thing that brought me back certainly was not identification. It was not aspiration. It was not wanting to be an AA. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I knew I was a guy with a lot of trouble. Knew that. But what brought me back to my second meeting, that's why I appreciate the spirit, and when I see any member, but particularly our older members, to have some spirit, some drive, and some energy. But that's exactly what brought me back to my second meeting. Not the words, not the hope, not I think I'll try this, none of that. I just found myself back there the next week. Couldn't have explained it to anybody. Nobody cared. Nobody would have cared if I hadn't come back. They wouldn't have even known it. You know, it'd just be one more empty chair here. Yeah, well, nobody would have said, where's that nice young fella that was here last week? Couldn't have cared less. They got their own troubles in there. They wouldn't be looking for me. And I wouldn't have cared. But that little sort of ray of hope that I got from that guy, he was a wonderfully enthusiastic person. God knows that's valuable. Oh, man, is that valuable. There are people, and thank God for them. You're talking about diamonds, eh, Carol? You know, give me those people who walk in and they change the character of a room by simply walking in. Thank God for that. And there are people like that. There are some that'll darken it when they walk in. But thank God for enthusiastic people. That's what I felt here with the energy and the enthusiasm of this bunch right here. And I value that because I think it's a healing force. God, that thing is so important. And so that's what brought me back. Now, for a good while, I did not become a convert. I truly didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I gradually got to the point I said I was. Because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that was something else. And so they all said they were. I said, yeah, me too. But it didn't mean a thing. It was just a word. Had absolutely no meaning. But I was fortunate. I think one of the other things that gave me the strong sense of value in a group was the group that I went into, the recovery group at Jackson, at Jackson Prison, will always be my home group. I just don't want to be a regular member. Yeah, but... But I'll always value that group because it was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You talk about a three-legacy group that does recovery, unity, service. I was blessed to get introduced to the program in that kind of a setting and found the energy and the drive and the sensitivity, strange word to use in a setting like that, but the sensitivity to pick up on people who needed a little nudge. That's what happened. I think some people in the group kind of picked up on the fact that I might be a guy who would respond. And so I just kind of got nudged into to activity in the program. And so gradually, just I won't go through it in any tedious detail because it's almost time to roll the clock back. But I was introduced in a very loving, sensitive, sensible way to, you know, back then we didn't do this detailed work with people going through the steps. I mean, that just didn't happen there nor anywhere else that I ever heard of. Yeah, and we just sort of scrambled through it the best we could, and that's what I did in there. I tell you what the beauty about the steps is, if we do them to the best of our ability, you can't screw it up. If you just honestly take the actions laid out there, you can't screw it up. And that's what happened. I just kind of fumbled my way through it. I had a hugely defining, transforming experience when I did the inventory. And I don't like to aggrandize any part of it. The most important step is the 12. because I think the truest definition, description of that I've ever heard is that little thing in the preface 12 and 12, that our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, not worked or studied or seminared or written or analyzed or videoed, that if practiced as a way of life, will enable the sufferer, will expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's exactly what happened to me in a maximum custody penitentiary. In living conditions that defied imagination. An environment where man's inhumanity to man was routine business. Where sincerity was considered stupidity. Kindness was considered weakness. And in an environment like that, I learned to live with dignity and freedom and honor as a human being. These are powerful principles, and they have little to do with your situation. What they'll do is transform a life. I became a free man when I was locked up like a wild animal, and I became a free man. First place I ever knew any sense of real joy and happiness in my life was in a maximum custody penitentiary. Only place I ever felt worth and self-esteem in my life. And it came from practicing these principles. These are powerful principles, powerful tools that will produce a new life. And I don't care what the situation is. I had a friend in an iron lung who practiced Alcoholics Anonymous. I really don't care about the circumstances. This sucker will work anywhere. Where there's a beating heart, this thing will work. And so that's what happened. And there's nothing good about that experience. I hated that environment with a purple passion. But his program was adequate to rise above that and live with dignity and carry myself and learn to be a gentleman, learn to be a real servant in that kind of an environment. I had a great experience in there. I guess I didn't know I was doing anything outstanding, but I was interviewed. I didn't know how unlikely this was to happen. I was interviewed for special parole when I'd only been in there 2 years. I didn't make it, but I was interviewed. And what I learned was that only happens about 1 out of 10,000 cases. And all I'm doing is practicing these principles as a way of life. I'm not doing anything special, but I guess it stands out. And I didn't make that parole, but it assured that I would be paroled on my first eligibility, if things stayed the same, and they did. And so I was released on condition that I go to North Carolina and not stay in Michigan. They weren't totally out of order there. So I agreed. And so I hit the ground. Just like anybody, whatever cage you got out of, doesn't make any difference. Whether the cage is a luxurious 13,000 big book parlor, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever that cage is, for broken marriage, a broken career, a broken heart, whatever, it doesn't matter. Whatever cage you come out of, I think all of us sort of have little dreams and hopes. And mine weren't anything peculiar. I had hopes and dreams. I wanted to be physically free, of course. I wanted to be a citizen. I never had been. Yeah, I was the kind of guy who brought down property values by moving into the neighborhood. I had never done anything citizen-like in my life. I'd never filled out an income tax form. I'd never voted. I'd never done anything that citizens do. I wanted to be a citizen. And by golly, I became one. I'm a pretty good citizen now. I vote all the time. I vote people I don't even know. I mean, I just kind of like the name. Because I remember when I couldn't vote. You bet I won't vote. I guarantee you they're going to have to hog-tie me. I usually vote wrong, but I have a hunch I might be right this time. I don't know. Anyway, no politics here. But anyway, I vote because it's a freedom and it's an expression of my concern, just like I'm concerned for my fellowship, I'm concerned for my country and for who I am. So I wanted to be a citizen. I am that, you know. And I wanted to be trusted. Didn't know if I ever would. I wanted to have a friend. I didn't know if I ever would. Because it was a whole new world. And I'm here to tell you that miracles truly do happen. And I hit the ground running. The second week I was out, somebody asked me to go to a prison and visit an aid group. I said, man, they're not going to let me in that place. I just got out. I'm on parole from maximum custody. They think they're going to let me go in? She may not let me out. That's a little uneasy, but he said, it's okay. It is a simpler day. So I went in. I got back so, carrying a message. I don't know what the message was, except I'm out. And but here I was. And so I really just took off, you know. And 2 months. I'm going to tell you, just right quick, like I'm just going to tell you some things, just in case you're wavering in the hope department. I know that everybody in here is not a Microsoft millionaire. There are folks, some folks have a run of bad luck, you know, sober or not. You know, and so anybody that's sort of hesitant in the hope department, I can't predict what's going to happen to you, but let me tell you what happened to me. I was as absolutely demoralized, demolished, but I was born again with some hope. And what I did was give the broken and wasted life that I've described to this simple program. And what's happened to me in the interim from that time to this is absolutely unbelievable. And I'll give you just a couple examples of things. And you go to the bank on this. I got no reason to shuck and jive you. What I'm going to tell you is an absolute truth. Things that I can't define any other way other than just absolutely miraculous. I'm a pragmatic sort of guy. I'm a deeply spiritual man. But I'm rooted in the fact that the spiritual life's not a theory, it's how we live. And my spiritual life is my life. I'm driven by that. And I'm a great believer in that. I believe what it says in the book, it's okay to have your head in the cloud, but keep those big feet on the ground. It doesn't say it that, but it's my interpretation of it. And so that's me. I'm grounded pretty well that way. I'm somebody who believes that miraculous things happen. And I'm not talking about magic shows. I'm talking about unbelievable things that happen. Like going to that prison the second week, I would have never thought of doing that. 2 months after I was out, I was asked to serve as outside sponsor, to be a trusted servant, a leader for a program in a prison, and I just got out of one. And I was honored. I couldn't have been more honored if it elected me governor. Truly, truly affirmed by that thing. About the same time, my parole guy came to me. And I'm nobody special. You know, I'm just who I've told you I am. And a guy came to me and he said, Tom, you real active in this AA thing. And I said, yes, sir. And it concerned me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down, and I knew I wouldn't. Because I was committed. This was my life. And the regulations were not my life. I knew that I wouldn't slow down. And so he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. As if he didn't know. You know, when I left the state of Michigan, they put in letters that big on my probate. This man's never operated a motor vehicle. I accepted that as a fact of life. He said, let me take a look at that. Called me a little later. He said, could you meet me at the Sears store uptown? Now, it sounds like Mayberry, but it was a long time ago. And I got my sister to drive me up, and I went back to the back of the Sears stores, and it happened to be where the license agency was. My guy's standing there, and I walked up to him, and they were chatting. I just didn't listen. I just sort of watched him talk. So he got through, and he turned to me, and my parole guy introduced me to the fella. And the fella said, Mr. Logan, my parole guy, he said, he tells me that you might be interested in having your driving privilege back. And I said, well, yes, sir, it would be helpful. And now don't ask me to explain it. That's God's business. Don't ask me to explain it. The guy handed me a driver's license. He already had it made out before I got there. No test of any sort whatsoever. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. He just handed me a driver. Didn't even pay for it. You call that whatever you want to. But that is absolutely amazing. I've had some people say, well, you must have been well connected politically. Yeah, boy. I knew every sheriff around there very well. And what I truly believe, that miracles are not, you know, mystical kind of thing. My definition of miracle is what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does introduction. And amazing things happen. Yeah, what I did was give that broken waste of life to this, and it's unbelievable the stuff that's happened. You know, what I've just cited to you. 5 months after I was out, I was elected DCM. I'd finished 2 years at Michigan State while I was locked up, but I barely could spell DCM. But I knew it was about service. And here I am, the same guy who wondered if he would ever be trusted, if he would ever have a friend, and here are my closest family saying, be our trusted servant in 15 cities. I took it with great appreciation. Now, see what I'm talking about? The restoration, that things come. If I give myself to this program and let it happen, not make it happen. I have never made, engineered, or manipulated any significant thing that's happened in my life. None of that. 2 years after I was out, I got a phone call one day from the state capitol. Fellow on the phone I'd met once. He dropped in. He was with the prison system. He worked in the headquarters. And he had come, I don't know if somebody told him to peek in on me or what, but he stuck his head in the AA group and introduced himself to him. We talked probably 2 minutes. And that was a man on the phone. And he said, Mr. Ivester. And I said, yes, sir. And that normally is trouble when somebody called me that. I said, yes, sir. And he said, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. Now, that would be a surprising phone call today. In 1961, I can't tell you how astounding that phone call was. There had never been an ex-con in the history of this planet hired into a correction system. I knew that. And I knew they weren't going to start with me. But if they're going to do it, they're going to start with somebody. And so I said to him, my God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine. I'd do it for nothing. And I just said to him, but I would have. And to myself, I said, there ain't no way. But I would remind you, when God's got work for us to do, walls come down. I don't care what those walls are. They come down. When God's got work for me to do, not when I want a job, but when God's got work for me to do. And so I went to work, the first ex-con in history, hired into a correction system. I couldn't talk with anybody about it because nobody had ever had the experience. One of my loves for AA tradition was that did more to help me find equilibrium and appropriateness in my professional life than anything I've ever done, far more than anything I ever learned in college. Now, I finished up my education in correctional administration after the fact, but my career was already established and going. But I learned AA traditions and principles did more for my professional career than anything. And so I just jumped into it, man. I honest to God, didn't even know if they paid. I'd never discussed salary with them. That wouldn't have made any difference. I figured I could steal enough to get by. And so, no, I figured it might pay me, and they did. And I thought it was an obscene amount. I just went to work, you know, and it's an amazing thing that what my experience has been that when you do good work, and what I did was I took every job I had with great gratitude and appreciation and gave it the very best I was capable of giving. And an amazing thing happens when you do that. There is a hunger. Believe me, I spent about 35 years of my career in management. And there is a hunger for people who are really task-oriented, who will really do a job, who will really give it their all. There's a hunger. A hunger for leadership, for God's sakes. And so I never, believe us or not, it doesn't matter to me, but in my entire career, I never applied for one single position, nor promotion, nor pay raise, nor transfer. What I did was give my best to every job, and somebody would come along and say, hey, would you do this? Sometimes it would, sometimes it wouldn't. But if it made sense to me and it seemed to be purposeful for me, I would do it. And one day, the most surprising thing that ever happened to me in my life, I guess, of the many things it did, the head of our prison system asked me to come by his office. We worked in the same building. Then he had something he wanted me to do. And I went by and chatted for 2 minutes, and he said, Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden. And I said, I'm in the system. But I'm one of the guys, good guys. I'm one of duking it out and mud wrestling with the guys, man, and I loved every minute of it. But he's asking me to be the man. And I said, oh, come on, boss, man, I don't want to be the head screw. I really didn't. I mean, my image of that was anything other than what I thought I wanted to do. And I said, tell me what you got in mind. And so he told me. And he knew. I mean, he wasn't interviewing me by accident. He knows how I am. I'm a creative guy. You know, I'm not a manager. I'm a leader. You know, I'm somebody who wants to make stuff happen. I'll guarantee you, if I develop something today, I'm working on the next increment tomorrow. I'm not somebody who manages and runs stuff. I'm somebody who tries to make stuff happen. He knew that, and that's what he was looking for. So he told me what he had in mind, and it had just enough creativity that he had me before we even got started. I said, all right, boss, you got it. Fasten your seatbelt. And that set out a 20-year increment of my career where I ran institutions. And my basic deal was that I was the go-to guy for developing new stuff that most people had enough sense to avoid. And so I'd just go for it. And I had an absolutely magnificent career. Went to the top of my profession with no intent to do so. Went to the very top. And further than I ever wanted to go, really, because if you get too far in management, you start getting disconnected from the personal contact with folk. But it was worth it because it was able to do stuff. Let me just wrap. It's about time. We'll wrap up around this for Bob. Okay, got you, Bob. Thanks. I'll make that. I tell you this, and I have to tell you to rush in a hurry because he's going to quit on me. When I walked out of that, I'm a pretty high-energy guy, always have been. And I'm not somebody who just sort of lopes along. I'm somebody who charges. And so when I finished my career and decided to hang it up, I'd put in 39 years of a high-pressure career with a lot of responsibility. And I had not heavy-duty stuff. A great thing about having a strong program in AA is that transition is a foreign language. My God, it's a no-brainer. All it is, quit doing one thing and just do a little more of something else. And so there was no real transition. But I had some notion that I might just take up golf or something, you know, just maybe play a little or go have a picnic or something, you know. And the word gets around today for an anonymous fellowship, we have an extremely efficient grapevine. And so word got out that I was going to retire. It took me a year to retire. So the word got out, and some of the folk from AA, that, I mean, I'd never been, I was no stranger. I was highly involved all the time in my career. But it came to me right before I was going to retire and said, we've got elections coming up in the area. Would you consider accepting the area chair job for corrections? Well, you can imagine what my reaction was. But come on, guys, give me a break, man. And they want me to go to work the day I retire. I mean, I'm not talking about a vacation period. They said it'll be effective upon your retirement. I said, oh, Jesus. And, I mean, you know, decisions are not difficult. Indecision's what's difficult. But I thought for just a second or two, yeah, not long, but I thought, you know, first thought was, geez, give me a break. But my next thing was, if there's anybody in this country that understands the dilemma of the alcoholic man or woman locked up, it's this guy. I have studied that. I doubt if it's been a day in almost 50 years that I haven't consciously pondered something about the dilemma of folks caught in those systems. And so I thought about it, you know, that if there's anybody who understands it, it's me. And if there's anybody that had access to a prison system, it was me. My God, by that time, I'd hired half the people in there, I think. And so I had real access. And so that took less than a minute, all of that pondering. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I'll tell you what made that a kind of an easy decision. I'm not a dedicated idiot. You know, I'm sort of idiotic sometimes. But I'm not a dedicated idiot. I'm dedicated. I'm purposeful. Some people say I'm obstinate, but it's not really obstinance. It's just dedication is what it is. Yeah, gotcha. But I said, yeah, I'll do it. And what I thought about was that my belief is if there is something in front of me that I know I can make a contribution in, my buddy knows about this, if there's something I can make a contribution, a need that I can address, and I walk away from it with selfish purpose just to satisfy my own comfort and convenience, ain't much to me. Ain't much to me. If I could walk away and turn my back, I doubt that you would want me here in this corner of Washington tonight. Because I can't do that. You know, if I look at that thing and I'm capable of making it, I'm responsible to do what I can. And so I went to work. My wife says it's the strangest retirement she's ever seen. That she wants me to go back to work so she'll see me once in a while. But I'm having a marvelous time. I am truly the busiest man that I know. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm geared that way. And this is exactly the way I want to go. I'm not somebody who wants to get into some sort of a state where I sit around and study my pulse at round the clock. Shoot, man, they'll tell me when I'm dead. I want to live till I die. And when I die, I want to be wide open. I want to be absolutely in charge mode. And the fact of the business is, after all these years, I'm not tired. I am not tired. The more I do, the more pumped I get. This kind of service does not fatigue me. It lights me up. I truly believe that I am the most fortunate man on this continent. It's because of this and because of that kind of stuff. And man, I wouldn't trade it. If you're not on fire with this sucker, for God's sakes, don't watch it like a tennis match. Get in here and get a piece of that thing and light it up. Man, there's stuff to do. Thanks. Yeah.